me Spaz. They call me Crip. They call me Mog. They call me Special. That's not my name.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, celebrating International Day of People with a Disability.
Call me Rita, but I'm a riot. Joey Deacon, always the same. That's not my name. That's not my name. That's not my name.
Able-bodied Australia does not realise that people with disabilities across the board are being discriminated against. Then the government to demand that we go out and get a job without removing the disincentives like the lack of access to transport and community infrastructure, without providing accessible buildings that can provide barrier-free employment. I'm not getting a fair go and I don't like it and I'm saying so.
You're listening to 3CR, 855 on the AM dial.
You're listening to 3CR, it is 8:55am. We've got a special two-hour edition of The Breakfast Show today for International Day of People with Disability. You'd normally be listening to Lost in Science, so we're going to have a bit of a science and techie-themed last half hour. And I'm going to speak now to Ray Walker from La Trobe University. Ray is an expert in public health based at La Trobe, and she's recently co-edited a book titled Climate Change and Adaptation for Health and Social Services. And that looks at some of the, amongst other things, at some of the risks and challenges for people with disability and their carers. Hi, Ray. Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Good morning.
Good morning. So what were the reasons for you and your co-editor, Wendy, bringing this book together?
Wendy and I had been working together for 5 or 6 years. Wendy was the executive officer of a primary care partnership called Enliven, and she was working with the member agencies around climate change. And we had worked through a number of issues like, you know, what's an appropriate framework for these agencies to be working within? In other words, what should we do? And we had arrived at the point where working with population groups, and disability was the first, people with disability was the first population group that we were working with, was actually the way to go for these services. It made sense to them. And if we took that approach, it became much clearer how they could incorporate climate change adaptation into the organisation's work across the board. And so we then thought, well, you know, there are multiple population groups that are highly at high risk from climate change. So we then brought in a whole lot of other experts who had done research and worked with a number of other population groups. And out of that, we put together the book. So it very much came from the services up as to what they understood as being the way to go.
Now, the chapter in the book that really focuses on the implications of climate change for people with disabilities is the one that you wrote.
Yes.
Are people with disability likely to be differently affected by climate change from the non-disabled population, if I can put it that way?
Yeah. Look, the answer to that is both yes and no. One of the effects of climate change is that it amplifies disadvantage. So, for example, if you live in an older house, as many people with disability do, and you are of low income, then your ability to adapt that house for, say, heat waves, to keep it cool or to keep it warm in winter, is very limited. It is very much limited. Whereas if you're well off, then you have the resources to insulate the house, put in, you know, energy-saving appliances, all of that kind of thing. So climate change amplifies existing inequality, and people with disability are impacted by that in terms of, you know, the usual suspects, employment, education, housing, transport. So in that sense, they are like other disadvantaged groups in regard to the long-standing issues that they have to deal with. But then on top of that, there is one issue that absolutely stands out for people with disability, and the only specific one to climate change around which there has been quite a lot of work done is around emergencies, because people with disability are much more severely impacted by, you know, the fires, the floods, the storms, those sorts of things that wreak havoc upon the environment that they live in and can break up their social networks. So in that sense, around emergencies, which are current, I mean, they're happening and they're getting worse, people with disability are much more significantly impacted. And the most dramatic impact is that the mortality rate for people with disability in severe emergencies is much higher than you would predict for their proportion of the population. On Black Saturday, a bit over 25% of the people who die had a disability. Their proportion of the population is 18%. So it was much, much higher than, you know, for other population groups. So that is the outstanding issue, specifically related to the impacts of climate change.
So I guess that's before, during and after emergencies as well. It's the communication of the emergency, being able to get away from whatever the threat is, and then being able to pick up your life afterwards is also much more difficult.
Absolutely. It goes right across the spectrum. The usual disadvantages that people with disability have around transport become massively amplified during an emergency and afterwards. Housing is a huge one. But also, during emergencies, people's support networks can get broken up, and that has a massive impact upon them.
Because your support services may not be able to get to you, I suppose.
And that as well, yes. Yes, look, it's a huge issue. And one of the things that we do have to remember is that there is immense variation between people with disability. For example, for people under 15, something like 4.5% of the population have a disability. If you're over 90, it goes up to 88%. So we have this a range of needs that need to be met. And currently, the thinking in the disability work that's been published from NGOs, from researchers and so on, is that we really need to focus on the practical things like communication, like transport, like services and support networks, those categories of things, not focus on specific disability. So it's the functional needs that people have, not their diagnosis, that we need to focus on. And that allows for people with diverse needs to actually begin to have some of their core needs met.
I know after Hurricane Sandy, New York City was found to have failed to protect its disabled residents because people weren't able to be evacuated and there hadn't really been enough detailed planning. Do Australian governments or councils have any specific obligations to prepare to protect people with disability or other vulnerable groups in extreme weather events or the longer term changes?
they kind of do, in that we've got a very very structured system of emergency planning that goes from, you know, state level down to municipalities. So that structure is there, but we don't have a lot of information from Australia, but certainly in the US, there is research evidence that says people who are doing the emergency planning actually don't know what they should be doing that would support people with disability. On some occasions, they'll just ask friends, you know, or they might ask someone they know who has a disability of some kind, but a systematic understanding of what the issues are and what works in addressing them is just not being developed. In Australia, we've got the Australian Council on Social Services doing a lot of work around emergency planning for disadvantaged populations. They're starting to begin to shift the way that the emergency planning system thinks about and talks about disadvantaged population groups, but that's a long way yet to go to actually have the systems in place that adequately support people with disability.
So if people are listening to this or they're reading your book and they're starting to be concerned about their own preparations, I mean, we're in bushfire season. Is there anywhere that people can start getting some tools or some advice on how to plan their own backup systems in the event that, you know, there's a tree over the road or they do have to evacuate their area?
Yes. And you're right to identify on planning, because the outcomes have affected in major ways by the qualities of planning that happens. The Australian Red Cross has put on its website a lot of information and outlines of plans for people. And there is a specific page that they have for emergency planning for people with disability. And it has like a template in which you can fill in, and it also has a whole lot of advice. And that's on the Australian Red Cross website. And if you like, I could send you through the web address for that if you like. But if you go to the Australian Red Cross website, go to emergency planning, and then look for the document on emergency planning for people with disability, it's fairly easy to find. So that's the best one. And that's a system of planning that was initially developed by the Red Cross in the United States and has been through a whole lot of iterations of improvement. And it's pretty good and pretty easy to use. But the other thing, of course, is that planning really needs to be done with a person's support network. Mm. So that the support network is able to contribute to the plan, but also is really aware of what's in the plan. So that doing it with the support network, both, you know, family, friends, neighbours, and services, is actually a really, really important thing to do.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Ray, on International Day of People with Disabilities. Is there any message you'd like to leave us with?
Look, I think it's fantastic that you're talking about climate change and disability, because, you know, we're already impacted by climate change and we have to be starting to adapt now, and it takes a long time for the whole community to adapt. And so by beginning to work on it explicitly now for people with disability is really important. So I think it's wonderful that you're talking about it.
Right. Thanks very much for joining us, and hopefully we'll be talking to you again.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And that was Ray Walker from La Trobe University. You can find Ray and Wendy's book, Climate Change and Adaptation for Health and Social Services. If you look for it's a CSIRO publication, you'll be find that if you Google. We'll be up next with the wondrous Jeanne Wild from Oz Accessibility.
One, two, three, four!
With Love Matters, a very important message to put on International Day of Disability, that love does matter. And into the studio tonight, we have got Jeanne Wild.
And even into the studio today, we have Wild. She's from Accessibility Oz. And before we get started to talk all things accessibility and technology. We were speaking before to Ray about her climate change book. Gian also recently went to went to Paris, I think, to also talk about climate change.
Oh, actually, it was New York. I went to the United Nations.
There you go.
Yeah, I spoke at the conference on the rights of people with disabilities back in June, and I specifically talked about the Black Saturday bushfires and how there was a huge percentage of people with disabilities who were affected and how people weren't talking about it. So it was absolutely fantastic to hear Ray, and I'll definitely be looking at that publication because more people need to talk about it. It turned out that 44% of the people that died were classed as vulnerable, which meant that they were under the age of 10, over the age of 80, or they had a disability. So, yeah, it's an incredibly important issue, and, yeah, I'm really glad that someone's dealing with it.
They are indeed, and we also need people to deal with accessibility of technology as well, because that's an area of it's an area of disadvantage for vulnerable people, including those with a disability. Now, what sort of accessibility challenges do people with disabilities face, Gian?
Well, if we're talking about the Black Saturday fires, for example, that was actually the topic of my talk, was that accessible technology was so incredibly important for people with disabilities because they rely on things like telephones and websites especially, and radio, television and things like that to determine whether they should leave, if they should leave, what, route they should take, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I focus on website and I suppose mobile accessibility. And back in Black Saturday, the CFA website was not fully accessible. They've done some great things now. When you're actually faced with a fire, you don't really have the time to figure out the best way to use a website if it's not fully accessible. So, there are things like people with disabilities might be relying only on the keyboard, for example. They can't use the mouse. They might have a vision impairment, which means that they need to increase the text size, and some websites won't allow you to do that. They might have quite a severe vision impairment, and they use something called a screen reader, which reads aloud the content on the site. And you can imagine if you have a map of, an area and, a graphic of where the bushfires are and what they're doing, how does that information get described to someone who's vision impaired? And that's where alternatives come into it. And, that's where it's really important.
How's accessibility going now that, now then, has it improved or are we still back in the Black Saturday ages?
I think it has improved a lot. Certainly, there's a set of accessibility guidelines that the Australian government has endorsed back in 2010, so we've been implementing them for 5 years. So Australia is really kind of leading the way in implementing these accessibility guidelines. And the other thing that's really changed is that in the last year or two, the United States has actually started implementing these guidelines as well, and you're seeing a lot of litigation, especially for universities who aren't providing course materials, in accessible formats to people with disabilities. And that's having a flow-on effect to, organisations in Australia because, they're all relying on the same kind of products and the same kind of technologies. So I think it is getting better. It is slow. And certainly Black Saturday brought a whole lot of things into perspective, and there were things like SMS alerts and stuff that the Rumby government implemented that certainly have helped, but it's a slow process. It is improving, but slowly.
I guess at a very basic level though, and I think Raphael might be in this category, people with disabilities can't afford to have internet access, or a lot of people can't afford to have internet access at home, so are then reliant on going to the library or some their local library or places like that to get internet access, which I guess it can is restrictive on in terms of the information you can get.
You're addressing the question to me, Phil?
Well,
just a general comment.
Well, it's a comment, but do you experience that, Raphael?
Oh, look, I said in my case with internet access, it's a lot of trouble was actually to find an internet provider that could actually access my building. And that was a bit of the challenge there. And then I got used to not having the internet for about 12 to 18 months. And I tell you what, it was the best 18 months of my life, just about. Seriously. And look, and that was just a statement. But I do realise that as far as accessibility goes, it meant that I had to become more aware and try to utilise what was around me and try to get people to, like, for example, accessibility with telephone banking. I'm dyslexic. When I hear numbers, they have to be chunked together, but most operators try to call them singly and they get annoyed when I call them all back in reverse order.
Raphael's just talked about challenges that he faced. Is that common for people with disabilities to encounter such challenges when trying to access websites? And
yes, certainly. A lot of people with disabilities, you know, they don't have, you know, a laptop or a, you know, a computer, and they actually, the only real access they have to the internet is through their mobile. And one of the problems with that is that the accessibility guidelines that I was referring to before don't have specific requirements for mobile. I wrote an article about that recently. And so although there are a whole bunch of things that you can do to make sure that a mobile site can be used by people who, say, attach an external keyboard or increase text size or things like that, they aren't implemented across the board by people. So, you know, you might have, you know, people whose real only access to the internet is through their mobile, and then they are restricted either to a mobile site that doesn't have the information they need, or it doesn't actually behave the way they need it to behave.
What about in terms of, you mentioned people having to use mobiles instead of the internet. How do smartphone, the two, I guess, dominant smartphone companies go at providing providing accessibility?
So, certainly in Western countries, the majority of people are using Apple products, so iPhones and iPads. And in general, Apple is pretty good for the mobile apps that are released on the Apple Store. They have a whole bunch of requirements that they need to meet, which makes them, you know, not wonderful, but, you know, pretty good in terms of accessibility. In terms of mobile websites, though, then it's really, you know, it's a bit of a mess. Android, it's not used as much. People don't focus on it as much. And unfortunately, the standard internet browser, it's called Internet, on a whole bunch of Samsung phones is not particularly accessible to users. So really when it comes to looking at Android devices, we have to test on Chrome, and we find that there's not a lot of users that actually do even download that and use that system. So, you know, certainly Apple is much better.
What sort of things for people to look for if they have a website or a mobile-enabled website, or you know, they're promoting their business or product or event or whatever. What do they need to be looking for?
So, firstly, the screen size on a mobile is so small that it's really important that you know that the site is clear and easy to understand. Probably one of the most important things that you can do is implement pinch zoom. So that's where you use two fingers to increase the text size. And that's used by everyone, not just people with disabilities. And we see that disabled on a lot of websites. Things like forms, if you've got forms, you know, error messages if they're not submitted properly, really good use of headings, really clear navigation, that kind of stuff.
And can I say just a personal bugbear of mine, seeing I do have this platform, is those catcher things. I can never get the catcher things in one go, and it really, dare I say it, 5 minutes tonight, a slight swear word here shits me.
Yeah,
because you can never get them in one go, and you're working there for about 20 minutes trying to get the bloody gotcha. And then they've got audio ones, but that they're almost indecipherable as well. So yep. How do you... That really limits access to things.
Yeah, captures are incredibly inaccessible. Our chief technical officer is vision impaired, and he can't actually use captures at all. And for a while there, when he first started, he was implementing all our Gmail accounts, and you couldn't actually create a Gmail account until you had completed a capture. And he couldn't actually do it. And this is a guy who's, you know, incredibly intelligent and very active, and he can't even create a Gmail account because of his disability. So, yeah, it's a real problem.
Fantastic. Well, I don't think we've even barely scratched the surface of accessibility or accessibility problems, but it's been a pleasure to slightly go into detail and talk accessibility with Jeanne Wild from Accessibility Odds. Thanks for joining us, Jeanne.
Thank you very much.
Yay. And thanks for coming into the studio. We'd love studio guests.
Anytime. Thank you so much.
No worries.
All right, well, we've just got a couple of minutes left. It's probably time to thank all of our guests today. So, Finn, do you want to start up with our guests?
I will. We need to thank Damien Griffiths, the CEO of the First People's Disability Network. We also need to thank Colleen Folinetto, I think that's correct. Sorry, Colleen, if that's wrong. We also need to thank Colleen and Ania. We need to thank Ray. Was it Ray Wilson? No, Ray
Walker.
Ray Walker. Sorry, from I should have been paying attention. From from which university was she from?
The Tribe.
Jeez, I'm going. This is the end of show quiz.
Yes.
Who were your guests?
Who was in the past 2 hours? Was Phineas paying attention? So she was from La Trobe University. And last but not least, someone I can tell you because I can clap eyes on her in front of me in the studio is Jeanne Wild from Accessibility Odds. Yay!
Thanks to all our guests. Thank you for listening for 2 hours of a big, bold breakfast with 3CR. It's been great fun, guys, do it again this year.
And I'm really looking forward to the next 10 hours of disability broadcast brings Helen.
Yeah. And the next edition of The Boldness will be broadcast on the 6th of December at 6 o'clock as well.
I think that's the 16th of December.
I did, the 16th.
No worries. All right. We're looking forward to the Spoken Word show again?
Spoken Word is up next.
Says he's paying attention.
Yep. And then after that, Talk Back with Attitude with Liz Wright. Call in and talk to Liz.
Magnificent.
Thanks to you all for listening.
See ya.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.